right, I call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Let the record reflect that it is 10 a.m. on Thursday, April 8th, 2021. Present today, we have Representative Klayman and myself, Chair Shragi. I know that we've got a number of members joining us here just momentarily, running a little late this morning. As we start, please remember to mute your cell phones. I want to thank our House Records Secretary, Leah Frazier, and our LIO moderator, Kelsey Riker, for helping us with behind-the-scenes work here that allows our committee hearings to run smoothly. Today, we will get an overview from the Alaska Energy Authority. The plan is to spend our hearing from the Alaska Energy Authority, and they will also be taking questions. Thank you for being here. I would like to welcome Executive Director Curtis Thayer to our committee. With that, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
All right, thank you for that. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And with me is Kirk Warren, who serves as our Director of Engineering and Energy Development, as well as Tim Sandstrom, who does rural programs for us, Director of Rural Programs. A little bit about who we are. We were created by the legislature as a public corporation in 1976, and our mission is a simple one: reduce the cost of energy in Alaska. And that stretches across from anywhere from Ketchikan to Barrow to Anchorage out onto the Aleutian Bay. What we do, we break down our authority within the Robot-Owned Energy, which is the Bradley Lake Hydro Project and the Alaska Intertide. And then we have power cost equalization, the power cost equalization program that reduces the cost of electricity in rural Alaska. We also have rural energy, which constructs bulk fuel tank farms, diesel powerhouses, and electrical distribution grids for rural villages, and that's about 197 communities. And then we also provide circuit rider and emergency response. And when I say emergency response is if the lights go out in some communities in Alaska, we are the 911 call. With renewable energy, AEA provides the renewable energy and energy efficiency grants and analysis. This includes hydro, biomass, wind, solar, and others. We also have grants and loans, more loans than grants these days. We have a power project fund that loans money out to rural communities and to businesses that are independent power producers.
And
we also,
If you could just let us know when you'd like us to proceed to the next slide. I can't tell if you have someone gesturing for us to proceed on, but if you want to just maybe cue what slide you'd like us to be on, we'll make sure that we facilitate that.
I apologize. Slide 3 we're on.
Thank you. Thank you. Please continue.
Right, and then with energy planning, which we collaborate with local and regional partners for economic and energy analysis across different spectrums across the state. So that's how we're broken down into. And on slide 4.
And let me interrupt you one more time. My apologies. Let the record reflect that Representative Rauscher joined us at 10:04 a.m. Thanks for being here, Mr. Rauscher. Representative Rauscher, please continue. Thank you.
On slide 4 represents our current projects. We currently, this could be anywhere from a PCE community that we deal with on a monthly basis to communities where we have powerhouses, bulk fuel, but it also includes our renewables for wind, river, solar, transmission, hydro, electric. This also includes our circuit rider program. And so at any one given time, we are actively engaged in approximately 500 different points, some multiple within one community, but it just kind of gives you the breadth of what we work with every day and every week. And it is literally across the state of Alaska.
Wonderful.
On slide 5, what is energy? Simply put, energy is the capacity to do work. And if we can lower the cost of that energy, hopefully that will have the capacity to do more work and bring new business into Alaska and lower the cost. On slide 6, it's just basic energy units. 1 watt is equal to a single LED. 1 kilowatt is what your toaster would use, and 1 megawatt will be for about 1,000 homes, and 1 gigawatt is 1 million homes. Alaska's not quite at the million, at the 1 gigawatt mark yet, but hopefully get there. On slide 7, power energy. Power is the watts per kilowatt that takes the flow up the rate of the water. And energy watts, or watt hours or kilowatt hours, is the amount of water that ends up in a bucket. We use that a lot with our hydro projects as far as Bradley Lake. We're always looking to increase the amount of energy into the lake to raise the dam amount, but the power that outflows from it is a certain amount and is limited by the generators there. In comparison to other part on slide 8, in comparison to the lower 48, ironically, Alaska is ahead of the game with renewable. 27% of our state is on hydroelectric compared to 2% in the lower 48. On truly renewable, we're only at 2%, and the lower 48 is at 9%. But when you combine those two, we're at 29% in renewables to their 11%. Coal, we're about half of what the U.S. is, and we're down on oil and gas. We're less than what the lower 48 is by 5%. However, they do have 8% of nuclear, and we do not have nuclear power in Alaska.
Mr. Thayer, I actually have a question, if you don't mind. On slide 8, you kind of talked about the energy breakdown for Alaska, and I was looking at slide 4 a moment ago, where we have the map of Alaska and some of the different power generation sources throughout the state. It's a pretty detailed map, but could you just speak briefly to maybe some of the differences in the regions of Alaska and their energy dependence and where they get that energy? Could you just kind of give us a narrative for this map?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. With the map, primarily we our hydro electric success is in Southeast Alaska, with a lot of communities that close to 100% renewable. Kodiak Island, through wind and through hydro, is about 100% renewable. Anchorage is about 10% of the power received by Anchorage or by the rail belt. All the rail belt utilities is about 10% of the overall power supply, and that's from Bradley Lake, which is an AEA owned asset. It's 121 megawatt power plant. And then we've done some wind in rural Alaska. The technology is there, but there are challenges in rural Alaska with some of the sensitivities of the wind farms there. High velocity wind is not necessarily a good thing. Steady wind is better, and I know we've had an issue with one particular wind farm where the wind blew too hard and the brake on the wind turbine itself failed, and that's been a challenge. We do biomass in some areas of the interior, and we have also, through our power project fund, we funded the largest wind farm in the state as well as the largest solar farm, and that's just outside Willow. So it's kind of a breakdown. Rural Alaska is more challenging, but clearly when you're along the coast and in the rainforest, hydro is to be the preferred choice. One thing that we can get to later in the presentation is the Sentinel Montana, for example. If the Sentinel Montana was built, it would provide 600 megawatts of power, which would immediately take Alaska from being 29% renewable to over 60%, which is that one project. There's a lot of little projects, but nothing would take us with a stamp of the fingers to that size. But we can talk about that later. The legislature has been supportive of that project, but right now there's been no movement on it by the administration or by the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. And let me just let the record reflect that Representative Kaufman, Representative Fields, and Representative Zolkowski joined us at about 10:07. And I believe Representative Fields has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair. Thanks, Mr. Thayer. Just had a question on Susitna-Watana and other hydro. Has there been modeling on the cost for Susitna-Watana versus other pump storage projects in the Rail Belt Corridor? I know there's been discussion of, I think it's Thunderbird Creek up above Aklutna, adding a facility up there and doing pump storage kind of linked in with the Klutna. I don't know if there are other pump storage opportunities, but just curious how much those have been analyzed and, as multiple hydro options in addition to Sousit and Wautauna. Thank you.
And if I could just jump in, Mr. Thayer, would you prefer us to address that question, or would you prefer to address that question when we get to the addendum? And I know you have a slide there on that project.
Perfect.
I can touch on it right now. Let me touch on a bridge right now because it includes the equipment piece, Mr. Chair.
I couldn't quite make out the question, but if you'd like to address that now, please proceed.
Okay. We continue to look at all projects, whether it be pump hydro or additional hydro off the rail belt. There's a lot of opportunity at Bradley yet to be developed. An advantage of Bradley is it's a state-owned facility. There is not really any issues with land ownership or fish issues, so to speak, with that project. So we've been looking what opportunities we can do to expand Bradley. When you look at a Klutna, we have done a cursory look at a Klutna, and there has been no geotechnical or any studying of that. One of the challenges that a Klutna does have is multiple ownership at stake. Not only do we have we have the federal government, we have the state, we have municipality, and we have native ownership of the land. And then also it happens to be the water supply for Anchorage. And so that provides an additional challenge on Klutna. And we have brought that issue up to some potential partners, and they do shy away because of those type of issues and concerns, and especially the water supply issue. And of course, there are salmon and other fish that are on that. When compared to a Sousit-Nawantana is literally 6 to 10 times the size of any of these projects, including Bradley, to looking at upgrading. But also with Sousit-Nawantana, it comes at a high cost, about $5.5 billion. There's more information later in the slide packet that I can get into and the benefits. It is technically feasible to build. There's no question about that. But it is an expensive project. The state has invested $200 million for its licensing. They are $100 million shy of a FERC license. But it's a project that would literally double the renewables on a statewide comparison overnight. There's support by the utilities in it because they're under pressure within their boards to reduce their carbon footprint and go and do more renewable. So those are some of the things. There's a whole on the back of your presentation and some slides on Sousit-Nawantana specifically that we can get into. But just Bradley, Klutna, Sousit-Nawantana, they're all ones that we are under consideration and have looked at.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thayer. Please proceed.
Please. And then when we go to slide 9, that's the urban energy. And when we talk about urban energy, I'm talking about Hallmark to Fairbank, directly up the rail belt corridor, the highway system. Our first ownership on slide 10 shows you Bradley Lake. It is located at the head of Hatchback Bay. It is the largest hydro project in the state of Alaska. It is owned by AEA, and if we were to construct that project today, it would be about $1 billion. It's 30 years old. It's actually still producing, and we found ways to put more water into the lake than you should do that. And an example, when I say always, 17% of the power produced at Bradley is used by consumers at Fairbanks. So it is shipped all the way north with utilities pulling off a predetermined share part of the Bradley Lake agreement. On slide 11, it talks about Bradley Lake itself. There's a picture of the dam. It's a picture of the dam doing something we don't like dams to do, and that's overflowing. Spilling water, that's spilling energy. But at the same time, that lake is at capacity, which is also a good thing. About 500,000 people depend on Bradley Lake. It produces 10% of the rail belt, and it's 4.5% power. And in comparison, when you look at natural gas is 8 to 9 cents a kilowatt, in essence. And when you look at Sitnawatana, again, these prices are 2013, but Sitnawatana is anticipated to be around 6 cents per kilowatt. So hydro tends to be cheaper than natural gas. One of our concerns, I think should be a concern for Alaskans, is some of the challenges that Cook Inlet have for continuing to provide natural gas long term. The gas is there, it's just at what price are we willing to pay for that gas. By having Bradley Lake, it saves the utilities about $20 million a year if, as opposed to using natural gas to produce the same amount of power. On slide 12 is West Fork of a Battle Creek diversion. AEA with the partners of the, with our partnering utilities spent $47 million and it added roughly 10% energy into Bradley, which equals about 5,100 homes. It was a 3-year project and it was completed in July of this year and it diverts water from Battle Creek into Bradley Lake. One of the pictures is a little small here, but the smaller picture in the lower left hand, what you see is pipe being fused. That pipe, that orange pipe, is 62 inches, and it was fused by the largest fusing machine in the world. And it was done the course of last summer. And what you also see is a road that did not exist before the Battle Creek diversion. That road was pioneered. It took 3 years for completion, and that project actually has won national awards for design and construction, and we're particularly proud of it. It was delivered on time and right at budget. On slide 13 is a recent purchase by AEA with help of the utilities, and that is we purchased the Sedona Quartz Creek transmission line. It's shown in rot and red dots. And basically where it takes you from is it's from the Sterling-Sedona area to through Cooper Landing. This is part of the line that was damaged by fire. It has also been the source of multiple million-dollar losses by the utilities. This line was a stranded asset within Homer's territory. They served no customers from it, yet they were responsible for maintaining it. And when the fire occurred, and it was down for 4 months, it cost the Northern Utilities $12 million. We negotiated for almost a year with the utilities and with Homer, and we purchased it for $17 million. And that's a key to upgrading the lines off of the Kenai Peninsula to increase the power that Bradley can produce. Bradley is 120-watt megawatt plant. The lines that stood it at 75 megawatts. Those lines predated Bradley, but they were never upgraded as intended. And really, to maximize Bradley, we need to upgrade those lines, and this is a key component of that. And that line section is roughly 39 miles. Homer Electric owns south of it, and Chugach Electric owns the lines north of it. On slide 14, I kind of jumped a little bit. It is just with that 39 miles, and it allows for better cost alignment, increased life reliability, and again, future prospects for the line. And the line purchase was supported by all the electrical utilities. And this was just a picture with the governor when he was overflying the line during the Swan Lake fire. Slide 15, we also own the Alaska Intertie, which is from Willow to Healy. It's about 170-mile segment of line. And on page 16 is a great picture of the line with Mount McKinley behind it. This allows Golden Valley Electric to connect to the grid, to the grid in South Central Alaska, and to purchase power from the other utilities and also receive Bradley Lake power. They receive an annual savings of $40 million from the state ownership of that line. And in essence, if they did not have access to that line or that line did not exist, it would cost them $40 million more to produce power in the Fairbanks area. I think it's important to note that when you look at what the state has done in the past, if they've invested in infrastructure on the rail belt, where in rural Alaska, the state has invested in an endowment for PCE. And when you look at the community of Fairbanks benefiting by $40 million a year, and our PCE subsidy to rural Alaska is roughly $30 million for roughly the same amount of people. So it's just how you kind of look at it. But this was an infrastructure that was designed and built and still provides savings to Golden Valley's consumers.
Can he
repeat that? On slide 17 is Matt.
Representative Zolkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Mr. Thayer. Can you repeat that, your comments about PCE and the impact in the Fairbanks area once more? Sorry, I missed part of that.
Okay. No, what I was pointing out was that the state invested in the infrastructure of Alaska Intertie, and that savings provides the Fairbanks residents with about a $40 million cost savings over being able to purchase a lower cost energy on the rail belt, including Bradley Lake, as opposed to producing in Fairbanks. Where in rural Alaska, the state has invested with an endowment fund to help pay for, power cost utilization, which is about a $30 million, subsidy into rural Alaska. So where the state had invested in the rail belt and St. Fairbanks $40 million a year, for roughly 100,000 people, and in rural Alaska, the state has the endowment, which invests about $30 million a year in rural Alaska for 82,000. So it's really, when you look at those, whether it's infrastructure or the endowment, they were both good investments, and they still deliver today for the Alaska consumers and lowering that cost of energy.
Follow-up, Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you. Just for the record, and I appreciate those comments, Mr. Thayer, I think that underscores the importance of protecting the power cost equalization endowment. We've seen unprecedented attacks over the last couple of years to dip into that power cost equalization endowment to make it sweepable, to obstruct the reverse sweep that protects that endowment and provides the equity that you're talking about. So thank you so much.
And Representative Tuck had a question as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you share with us what the purchase price of that intertie was and who sold it to us?
That intertie, I don't have the cost of it, but it was built by AEA, who is the director of engineering. You might have a cost of what it was at the time.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Tuck, my name is Kirk Warren. I'm the director of engineering and the Alaska Energy Authority and responsible for the owned assets for the authority. The capitalization of the Alaska Intertie was $125 million, Representative Tuck, the original purchase price, or not purchase, but construction price.
And what year was that?
It was completed in 1980.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Please proceed.
On slide 17 is looking at maximizing clean energy for the rail belt. And what this is looking at what we need to do to improve the power lines, upgrade the power lines off of Bradley Lake. We have Bradley Lake to Sedona, which is $66 million to Quartz Creek. Not the Quartz Creek, which and substation, which we own, AEA owns, about $70 million. And then Dave's Creek, it connects right into the Quartz Creek and takes that line right into Fairbanks. Tugas has done a lot of upgrades on that line, so that cost is not as much. Another project that we're working with utilities on is Bradley Lake expansion, and that is to raise the spill of the dam so we get more acre feet of water behind the dam. And then grid stabilization, which is really batteries, looking at putting batteries, and I say not AEA, but working with utilities to figure out in Hallmark, Anchorage, Fairbanks to help stabilize the grid. And then another project that we look at is Bernice Lake to Beluga, and that is taking a line basically by the Hallmark and putting an HVAC line over to Beluga as a secondary source. So we're completely circled around right now. Coming off of T9, we just have one transmission line, and this would provide a secondary transmission line, especially if we get additional power out of Bradley through continued work on Bradley.
And Representative Fields has a question.
Thanks, through the chair. I know the Biden administration just introduced an infrastructure package, which, as I read about it, seems like a combination of surface transportation and energy. Has AEA analyze that to determine the path through which funds from such a bill might support projects like these, or is the bill too recently introduced to understand that quite yet?
Let me take a step back. We have just completed our analysis of the December COVID money, the $1.9 trillion, and there are opportunities with the AEA, but even in December's bill, the regulations haven't been propagated to know what they are. And since then, Congress has passed another COVID bill, and now the president has introduced the infrastructure bill. So we are looking at each one of those three. We are in contact with the congressional delegation. Matter of fact, this afternoon I'm meeting with Sarah Sullivan's chief of staff to discuss what's in that bill and the process. And so we are looking at those opportunities. But like I said, we were just looking at December's, figuring out where we best fit in, and now two more, you know, there's trillions of more dollars on the screen. So we continue to look at that and the rules around that. But a lot of the rules haven't been determined yet.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
On slide 18 is just something we're currently doing is we have some funding from the Volkswagen settlement, and we're looking at doing a EV, electric vehicle, charging corridor, and our first phase is from the Kenai Peninsula to Fairbanks, and what we're doing is looking to partner with SiteHost and to develop 10 to 14 locations, roughly 50 to 100 miles apart, to provide electric charging stations. And then we have a phase where we would also look at Glen Allen, Hope, and the back, and along the Parks Highway, in addition to into Canada and Southeast Alaska. And so these are just different phases. This phase is about $1.2 million. And again, it's federally funded, and we've just we have the RFP out, and we expect that closes on May 5th. So at a future meeting, we can kind of tell you where we're at, but we hope to have these charging stations introduced and available to consumers late this summer, if not early next summer.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that that Volkswagen settlement, a lot of money came up here to Alaska, and I know a lot of it was upgrading power generation plants, making them more efficient, the DERA projects. Right. I saw a head shake no, now I see a head shake yes. So the DERA projects, and I was just kind of curious, how much money did the state of Alaska receive on that settlement? And then how much, after doing a lot of the good upgrades that you guys have been doing, how much is left over for this DC fast charging corridor?
Thank you for that question. Primarily, the money was used, we were divided into separate areas. They were went out for public comment of how the money was to be determined as far as the public. And what we ended up doing is paying for a lot of new school buses that reduced the NOx emission. And these school buses were a lot in rural Alaska, some in urban. And I think there's about a total of 30 school buses that were purchased with that. And then there were some DERA projects that were also funded, also to remove the emissions. And then we also provided funding for an electric bus at the Juneau, as well as an electric dump truck, in Anchorage. And then $1.25 million was set aside out of the $8.7 million was set aside to do these fast charging corridors. So it was broken up in different buckets of money, and this really is the last phase of the $8.7 million versus $1.25.
Thank you. And then Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, when we use the phrase fast charging, I'm just wondering, what's the state of the art right now with respect to fast charging from a, you know, nearly empty to full in terms of charge?
Half hour.
Yeah. Where are you going? Representative Poppin, through the chair. For this, we're looking at the level three charges, which is roughly a half hour to 45 minute charge from zero to fully charged.
Representative Poppin, through the chair, this is Kirk Warren again for the record. There are technologies in the level 38 that are being explored now for what's called ultra fast charging stations that can charge a car in 5 minutes. The technology is being developed but it takes power flows greater than any of the rail belt utilities could support on our transmission network currently.
Follow up, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Follow up, not, I guess the backwards compatibility and forwards compatibility, any risk of building infrastructure that's not compatible either going forward or going back?
Representative Kaufman, through the chair, we are, you know, what we've laid out is the most current and most popular type of charging that is available. So I don't think there's a chance of going back. Definitely going in the future, I think the charging will change and probably be a lot quicker than what it currently is. But we are doing level, there's only three levels, and we are using level three. Level one, two, and three, level three chargers. Another consideration that we have in Alaska, and that is our temperatures. A lot of the charging stations are not made to go to 40 below. And there, I believe there's two charging stations that are companies that produce them that are certified for 40 below. And so we have to look at those when we look to install those, in the interior of Alaska. So that does limit our choices too.
One more follow-up.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Representative Tuck.
Thank you. So these charging stations, are they going to be like coin operated, you know, like a telephone booth or or actually more like a car wash, I guess? You know, actually, what you should do is you should turn it into a car wash and a charging station all at the same time.
That's a bad mix.
But do you plan on having some sort of payment where someone can pay on? Is that the whole intent? Or how is these charging stations... Are these just convenience, or is it a revenue generator? I guess is my question.
We anticipate these are going to be used credit card operated, where they'll swipe a credit card for a charge. What AEA is doing is providing 80% of the infrastructure. You're still going to have private businesses and site hosts that have to maintain those charging stations and pay the electric bill for those charging stations. And so that is the reason for the credit card swipe. But it is less than a tank of fuel in today's rates. And so it's very competitive, but not quite a bit cheaper. We only have about 1,500 electric vehicles registered in Alaska. But what I would anticipate is once electric vehicles move into the SUV in the truck market, we're going to see a huge demand. And so what we're trying to do is get the backbone for the public sector to help develop these throughout. We have electric charging stations level 2 and 3 in Anchorage and in South Central Alaska and obviously in Homer and other areas of the state where we don't have a lot of infrastructure in Fairbanks, especially along the highway corridor. Some of these vehicles, they can do 250 miles, so that doesn't get you to Fairbanks. And it doesn't get you from Homer to Anchorage. If it does, you're probably pretty nervous. But one of the challenges that we have is where does the charging station go from Birdwood to Cooper Landing? There is no ability. There's no resources there for charging stations. So those are some of the challenges that we're working through as we do this. But again, it's a partnership with the private sector.
Thank you. And I see no other questions at the moment, so please proceed.
Thank you. We are going to rural Alaska and power cost equalization. I think there's a lot of information on that, but power cost equalization provides electric power to rural residents. And how that is established is they look at the cost of power in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, that they being the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and they establish what that rate is, and then AEA to the PCE program will pay the difference between what that blended rate is up to 550 kilowatts for residential and community buildings. This does not cover government buildings. It covers just rural residents. There's currently 194 eligible communities that receive the benefit of the PCE. And last year, the program disbursed close to $30 million. We anticipate that price to be roughly be the amount for FY21. And the PC endowment is capitalized at $1.1 billion. And the way the earnings are derived from the PCE is the first tranche, as I would say, of earnings pays for the PCE program. Then if there's in excess of $30 million additional, that goes into community assistance in rural Alaska. And then if the earnings will support it, up to $25 million will go back into powerhouses, more bulk field loans, or into the renewable energy fund. We've only had 1 year where the earnings have been so great that we could do the PCE and the renewable energy fund, but it generally does pay for all of PCE and pay for a good portion, if not all, of the community assistance. And those are set by statute, that funding formula.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. Representative Zulkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. Can you remind me, does the Renewable Energy Fund fund projects statewide?
Through the chair, Representative Zulkowski, yes, it does. Primarily rural Alaska. And what I'd say primarily is I know that we are currently in a round. We have 11 candidates. One of them is Cordova, which one could argue is rural or not, but 10 of them are definitely rural Alaska programs. So that's where it primarily benefits. And the state has invested about $280 million over the last 15 years into renewable energy funds.
Representative Zulkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just Mr. Thayer underscores a great point about how the PCE endowment also benefits urban Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. I see no other questions.
All right. Thank you. On the next slide, 21, we have a little digital animation. And if we could just roll that. And what this is AEA this last year has overtaken 3D imaging in the rural powerhouses. And this not only helps us understand and know what's happening currently in the powerhouses, but it helps us help the operators in the community of those powerhouses. So we can actually see what they're seeing, and their manuals attached to certain tags. I'll just introduce the end of the video. Thank you. So what you're seeing is what our operators in Anchorage, our circuit riders can see, and also when dealing and working with the local operators. So when they're looking at manuals or they're actually looking at the machinery, they understand, and it's really helped us, especially in the world of COVID, where it's been harder to get to rural Alaska to travel. And right now we currently have 2/3 of the powerhouses in rural Alaska completely. And while we're there, we're also working on doing this with the bulk fuel tank farms.
Question.
Representative Fields?
Thanks, through the chair. Well, that's very exciting. Is this kind of remote assistance going to be used kind of in lieu of what previously might have been a standard circuit rider visit to check in person, or is it more for, hey, there's a problem, we're going to help out right now, or is it both, or is that not known yet? Appreciate it.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I would probably anticipate this is a little bit of both. If we can handle and deal with the situation that does not involve travel, we would prefer to do that. But at the same time, we understand there are, you know, there's certain things that the circuit riders and our maintenance folks have to do in rural Alaska and in these communities. But again, from if you can imagine trying to help somebody on the phone without having any diagram or looking at their power plants, this is tremendous technology that we're using that is being very well received.
Thank you. I see no other questions at this time.
Thank you. Rural power system upgrades, there's 197 communities that receive rural power system upgrades. And our goal is always to improve the power system and efficiency. We do have a lot of aging infrastructure. And in these two pictures, in the other upper left-hand corner, is a new powerhouse. Nice new generators. These powerhouses are usually built in Anchorage. They're 14 feet by 46. And then they are shipped out to rural Alaska. The cost of them is roughly about $3 million a piece. And down below, which is a village that I was on that trip. And if you notice in the forefront, there is a missing generator. And the next two generators in a row did not work. And we had an emergency one out in front of the building that was the whole thing with the community. We have gone in since and replaced the three generators. The powerhouse we didn't need to replace with the generators. We currently have 7 active projects. And the deferred maintenance in rural Alaska is a little over $300 million. On the next slide.
Let me interrupt you just for a second, Representative Fields.
Thanks, through the chair. Does the governor's proposed capital budget, I think HB 70, address any of these deferred maintenance needs? And if you have a list of the deferred maintenance broken down, I'd appreciate reading that. Thank you.
Okay, if we go to page 23, we have the list of the governor is requesting $5 million this year. We should be able to receive a $4.5 million match from the federal government for 17.5. And these, we have them in order of the capital request. So if we would receive the $5 million, our top communities are the first 4 listed. And then the next, our PSU priorities follow. These priorities are set out by statute, based on need and based on what the community is able to help with match. And so, I don't know if this answers your question per se, but we can get you a list of 71 other communities involved in the order that we're doing. And going back to the federal funding opportunities, we are looking at several different buckets of federal funding that would be available, and that we are working with the congressional delegation on sharing that list to see if not only will they look at these projects, but another 50 behind them. And that's the ongoing discussion. The one thing that we might be challenged with the president's priorities is this is for a diesel powerhouse. Granted, some of these rural communities do have some renewables tied into it, but the backbone of these communities are diesel, and we might run into a little bit of headwinds on that subject. I'll leave it right there if this answers your question or if you need further information.
It does. I do have a follow-up. If the legislature added money in terms of the capital budget, would that bring with it additional federal matching dollars, or are we already maxing out our federal match?
Those, through the chair, those are conversations we would like to have with our federal partners. The legislature, and with all due respect, not on anybody currently in the legislature, but the legislature during the last 5 years, and previous administrations, not just this administration, there's been $47 million that the state lost in federal match because they didn't necessarily fund these programs. And so I know our partners understand the need, and I think that if we provide additional state funding, we could increase the federal match.
Quite the missed opportunity. Okay, we're going to go to Representative Kaufman and then Zolkowski, and then we're going to hold questions. I know we have about 10 slides left and a hard stop at 11, so I want to make sure that we're able to get through those and then circle back for additional questions. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, deferred maintenance is often attributable to a lack of funding, but there's I've personally seen in my career there can be other reasons, just management of maintenance programs of just having good, robust maintenance procedures and personnel in place. Is there a mix of factors in the deferred maintenance? Is it all lack of funding, or are there other causal factors?
Through the chair, Representative Coppin, there's a little bit of combination of all of the above. The powerhouse normally lifespan would be 20 years, and we've been able to replace about half of those in the last 20 years. So that does leave 20 more, it leaves about 100 more outside of being completed within a normal 20 years lifespan. one of our challenges is, in rural Alaska, we have some have utilities like ABEC, which are tied to these utilities. They perform the maintenance. They do good. They're on top of it. We also have about 50 communities that they're too small to have a utility associated necessarily with them. And so they're ones that we literally hold their hand and work with. We provide the training. We go out there and assist them. But these communities are also challenged in keeping their workforce. These operators are one, two people. They get the training. They go to AVCAC. And then if there's an opportunity in another village or they work for one of the utilities like AVCAC, they will go that general direction. Our circuit rider program is five people, and they cover 197 villages. Four people. They cover 197 villages. And so we do our best, but again, some of our challenges in some of these villages is just the changing of the oil and filters and routine maintenance. Once these powerhouses are in the community, they're the responsibility of the community. We would just assume that really the moral obligation of maintaining them and making sure the lights are on in rural Alaska.
Thank you. Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thayer. About 10 years ago, the state of Alaska was able to invest quite a bit more in energy planning just for communities statewide. Can you speak to the technical assistance resources that are currently available to communities, tribes, and nonprofits through AEA, and how has that changed over the course of the last decade?
Through the Chair, Representative Zolkowski, this is Tim Sampson, Director of Rural Programs for AEA. We have spent a great deal of time increasing the robustness and the scope of our training programs. We partner with AVTEC and Field for on-site funding. We developed online through our federal funding department. Now, we have funded a bulk feeder and powerhouse operating training. So within the 3D imageries, you saw that technology. There's our attempt to really expand the ability to improve the operations and maintenance of these facilities.
Did you want to follow up, Representative Zolkowski?
Yeah. Sorry, we're having a little bit of breakup on this end, so just hoping you could touch on how that technical assistance capacity has changed over the last decade and what the legislature could do to support your continued work in that area.
So sorry about the breakup. We've greatly increased our online training with AVTEC. We have, with a federal funding partner, the Denali Commission, funded itinerant bulk fuel and operator training. And then the technology that you saw with the 3D imaging and also including the plan specifications, operations and maintenance training videos is the way we are trying to improve the operations and maintenance throughout rural Alaska.
Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Thayer, please continue with the presentation. I'm going to ask committee members to hold questions until the end, and we'll use any remaining time to answer those questions. Thank you.
Okay, fair enough. Page 24 is our bulk fuel upgrades. There's about 400 rural bulk fuel facilities. Our goal is to get them code compliant for fuel storage, prevention of spills, contamination. They are aging. The lifespan of a bulk fuel is close to about 4 years with proper maintenance. We currently have 8 projects in replacement and 18 in maintenance and improvement. We are working with the Coast Guard to capture these assessments and using similar technology for the powerhouses. And the deferred maintenance on the bulk fuel is about $800 million. On slide 25 is where we have the state, in the governor's budget, there's a request for $5.5 million. We hope to receive federal receipt authority also at $7.5 million. I will be important to note, the state has not funded this program for 3 years. So in essence, we've left over $20 million on the table by not providing a federal state match. But we've identified the three communities. There are fewer communities because there's a higher cost of bulk fuel. And then the next priority list from Minnesota to Tulsa. And you'll see what the picture references what a new bulk fuel power or new bulk fuel would look like in rural Alaska. We have also grants and loans. The Renewable Energy Fund is our current. We're currently in what we call Round 13. The state's invested $268 million. This picture is ORPC, which is doing a river gen to develop power out in Bristol Bay for a local community, Iyagi. There's 99 operational projects that we oversee, 27 are in development. We have a request before the legislature to fund round 13, which is for 11 projects at $4.7 million. And it's a reappropriation of previously REF money where they come in under budget or were canceled. So we're not asking for new money. We're just asking to reappropriate existing funds. And we do that. The program does sunset on June 30th, 2023, just to kind of put that as a mark on the calendar. And then on slide 28 is our power project fund. We currently fund various projects, not only in rural Alaska, but some in urban. And the power project fund currently has $31 million in outstanding loans. We have funded the one of the largest hydro projects in Southeast, the largest solar farm in Alaska, which is a little, and the largest wind farm outside of Fairbanks. We currently have $8.7 million available for lending, of which we have pending applications of $5 million. The current interest rate is set by statute and is at 2.83%. So it's very attractive money. One of our most recent ones is we did provide funding for the Baxter Senior Living, the co-gener units there. They're an independent power producer selling into the two gas grid. And so that helped make that senior center a little bit more affordable. And then this is where we get into the addendum in our last few minutes. We have a Sitnawatana animation, which is about a minute, Why don't we just play the Sitnawatana? This was prior to drones. This was done 10 years ago. The music is new. I hope you appreciate it, but it's been 40 years in the making. So if you could play it for us. Thank you. And like I said, with 40 years in the making, I don't know if it's mission impossible, but it is something we keep talking about. Basically, a little bit of overview on the project itself. The dam height is about 700 feet. It would create a reservoir of about 42 miles long. And the maximum installed capacity would be over 600 megawatts, which in comparison to Bradley is 120 megawatts. And it could light up almost 390,000 homes. The cost in 2014 dollars is because this is the last time the cost benefit analysis was done on it was in 2014 was $5.6 billion. But with that, the benefit cost ratio at that time was 2.39 from energy savings alone, which was over $11 billion in the first 50 years of operation. And, again, these were done in 2015 with the study that was done there. The state has invested $193 million for its licensing. The cost to complete is about another $100 million. There's been 58 FERC studies that have been done and implemented. 19 are complete. 39 are certificate progress has been made. And FERC is holding the license application in abeyance. There's nothing preventing us from starting this other than the willpower and the dollars to start it. And that was a little bit about Sitnawatana. We have more information, so looking at the clock, I'm available for any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thayer. Do we have any questions from committee members? Representative Zukoski.
Thank you. Mr. Thayer, has the Alaska Energy Authority looked at developing funding models for funding energy infrastructure projects throughout Alaska? I ask this question because in work that I did a number of years ago, there were tribes that were interested in taking out loans to upgrade power systems, but traditional lending did not provide an opportunity to those projects were too small for some of the traditional lenders in the energy project kind of field. So has AEA been looking at developing any funding models that could be utilized in communities where it will have great impact, but maybe from a banking perspective does not provide the incentive for traditional energy project lenders to get into that business?
Through the chair, that is the purpose behind the Power Project Fund, our PPF. We have funded small projects in Alaska as well as some larger ones. That is the fund that we have $31 million invested, of which about $8.7 million is still available. And I don't have a name for the communities. The three applications that are pending are all rural Alaska communities. And we work with them to make the terms attractive. And I would say that we offer a lot of capital in regards to that loan program. I think that's what you're talking about.
Follow-up.
Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. I'll follow up with you and your team offline. I'd be interested in talking about an opportunity to ensure that that's as flexible as it can be for communities that are willing to take out loans in order to improve their energy systems. Thank you.
Wonderful.
And are there... one thing I do apologize to the committee that I did not mention in the slide packet, but it is going to be pending in Juneau. And that is we do have a request of the legislature for $21 million for the Federal Seed Authority. We successively worked with the Alaska Cargo and Cold Storage for a 700,000 square foot air cargo facility at Penn State International Airport. We received a highly competitive grant from the Department of Transportation for $21 million for energy efficiencies on that building that is being built. A little feather in the cap is most people, when they look at AEA, don't realize that we created 2,000 construction jobs with this grant. It was the largest grant on the West Coast. But you'll see that $21 million authority, but that is what that's for.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to give the last question to Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to mention I represent South Anchorage, and as we get out of session, I'll be looking forward to dropping in, spending some time, and just get to learn more. So I'll try and have my staff reach out to.
Are you unable to hear us currently?
No, the screen has additional information on it. I need to ask the person to leave. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Representative Kaufman, would you like to try again?
Yeah, so anyway, I'd like to set up a meeting again when we're out of session, just kind of a learning opportunity to drop in and meet in person, hopefully without masks and distance at that point. Thank you.
Thank you. And for the whole committee, please, anytime you have information, please come to our offices. And if we're able to this summer, we'll be more than glad to host legislators down at Bradley Lake and to see Bradley Lake as well as the Battle Creek Diversity.
Wonderful. Well, with that, I want to thank Curtis Thayer, Kirk Warren, and Tim Sandstrom for making the time to present to us today. We sincerely appreciate it. And with nothing else before the committee, this committee is adjourned at 10:59 a.m. Thank you very much.
Thank you.